ideas as well as conduct business with each other. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
The U.S. and the Human Rights Office have partnered to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights through 2018. However, some countries in North Africa are retreating their approach to basic human rights. Some human rights organizations accuse Egypt of having the worst record of violations. But Egypt's foreign ministry says its government will promote human rights based on the values of citizenship, equal rights, and the rule of law. Ahmed Ben Chamsi, Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi how the human rights situation is different from one country to another.
Well, obviously, it depends on the country we're talking about. I mean, the situation is pretty different from one country to another. It's better in some countries than in others, even though we generally do not like to compare situations between countries, because we believe that every human rights violation is a problem of its own and should be rightly addressed and denounced. But the general scale of violations in Egypt, for example, are way, way worse than what we could see in other countries like Tunisia.
So which country in North Africa you detect the worst record of human rights and which is relatively better?
Well, again, we're not very comfortable in giving labels worse and better. But, I mean, all things considered, I think the situation in Egypt is pretty dire right now. It is in many ways surpassing state violence and repression that happened during the Mubarak era or the Morsi era. What we're seeing is that basically Sisi have given the Interior Ministry a free hand to exercise coercion with near absolute impunity, under the justification of restoring stability and fighting terrorism. So there are many abuses, including arbitrary arrests, torture, enforced disappearances, which we called a potential crime against humanity, extrajudicial killings, and death penalty by the hundreds. So, I mean, it's really a very, very dire situation. I would venture that this is probably the darkest situation of human rights in all of North Africa at this moment.
But Egyptian Foreign Ministry reaffirmed Egypt's adherence to promoting human rights and said the Constitution of 2014 laid down unprecedented provisions for protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms. What's your response?
Well, our response is that they can say whatever they want, but there are hard numbers. Like more than since 2013, at least 60,000 people have been either arrested or charged for reasons related to freedom of speech or freedom of opinion. 19 new prisons have been created to manage this huge influx of detainees. More than 15,000 civilians have been tried before military courts. Like disappearances count by the hundreds, if not the thousands. So, I mean, they can have whatever assurances they want in the Constitution, but the reality says otherwise.
So what should the U.S. do to help promote human rights in the Middle East?
Well, they should stop supporting dictators, for one. They should stop patting them in the back and giving them incentives to continue oppressing their people and stop continuing business as usual with those dictatorships without making them more accountable for the human rights record.
That was Ahmed Ben Chamsi, Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Most scientists agree that climate change caused by greenhouse gas emissions, deforestation, and other factors is a fact of life, but that it is possible to help slow the rate of change. One way to do so is to manage the natural resources and healthy habitats that remain. One strategy for conserving the forests that produce much of the world's oxygen is to allow the indigenous peoples who have lived sustainably in them for millennia to own and continue to care for them. VOA's Adam Phillips examines the role that forest peoples can play when their rights to use their traditional lands in traditional ways are respected.
Indigenous peoples make up a significant portion of the world's population and belong to a staggeringly diverse array of cultures. Yet they share many common features and grievances, says activist Joan Carling of the Philippines, who received the 2018 Champions of the Earth Award at the United Nations.
We are very marginalized. Our land rights are not recognized. Our culture and ways of life are also undermined or considered inferior. But the positive thing is that we continue to persist. We continue to assert our culture. We continue to assert our relationship with our environment. And we continue to conserve and manage our resources in a sustainable way. We believe that we are stewards of the environment for the future generation.
According to the Rights and Resources Coalition, indigenous peoples claim and manage over 50% of the world's land. And while they own only 10% of that land, many rely on it for their food, medicine, and traditional ways of life. Agnes Lena is founder of Community Concerns, an indigenous grassroots group in the forests of Kenya.
The spiritual connection between animals, ourselves, and the forest. It's through the forest that young men are initiated into men. And all the sacred trees, the sacred leaves, the sacred gums are actually found in that forest. So that's why we depend on the forest for everything.
As the global demand for commodities such as palm oil, precious minerals, and hardwoods grow, indigenous lands are increasingly vulnerable to plunder by multinational corporations and other powerful interest groups. But ultimately, of course, sustainable land use and climate change mitigation are in the interest of corporate and government players as well. Penny Davies is program director with the Ford Foundation's Natural Resources and Climate Change team. She says that's why she supports indigenous peoples who insist that they should own and manage the forests, not corporations or governments.
Remote rural communities in forest areas, in parts of the Congo Basin, in Cameroon, in Liberia, Ghana, where there is still high forest and communities that are experts with deep knowledge on how to manage those forests and live from those forests. Local communities are the climate solution that you should be supporting. And so there are global multinational companies who have committed to removing forest loss from their supply chains. They have said we will only source products that we can prove are not causing human rights violations or pushing communities off land or clearing tropical natural forests. Over the past 5 years, 450 companies, global companies, have made that commitment.
Which is not to say that indigenous practices themselves are always environmentally friendly. To pick just one example, in Malawi, where only 5% of the population has electricity, indigenous forest peoples routinely and indiscriminately chop down trees for use as cooking fuel. The smoke from those fires actually contributes to global warming, and destroying forests also erodes the soil, pollutes rivers and streams, and kills the fish, and leads indirectly to drought and famine. What is needed in Malawi, experts say, is sustainable infrastructure and energy development, greener cooking technology, and indigenous ownership and management of the forests and their renewable bounty. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Hello, Africa. This is James Brotte, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
You're listening to a special edition of Africa News Tonight from the Africa Service of the Voice of America.
The right to own and farm land is crucial to economic development in many parts of the world. In South Africa, the old apartheid government denied most black citizens access to the best of the nation's vast agricultural land. More than two decades since apartheid ended, white South Africans still control the bulk of the nation's largest commercial farms. The ruling African National Congress is pushing forward with new legislation to change that, but the plan is controversial.
VOA's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg has been covering this story all year. He tells our colleague Kate Pound-Dawson that the problem is not opposition to increasing black ownership. It's a question of doing it without disrupting a productive agricultural economy.
I think everyone at this stage here in South Africa, everyone who's reasonable, perhaps with the exception of the most hardened of white supremacists remaining in the country, they agree that the country needs more black agriculturalists to produce food on a large scale. Now, aside from this practicality, to have most of the prime farmland in white hands almost a quarter of a century after apartheid ended is morally unconscionable. But it's also a fact that at the moment, about 34,000 white commercial farmers are growing almost all the food that South Africa needs to feed itself, and certainly all the food that the country needs to export. Now, does the ruling ANC risk this by taking white farmers' land and giving it to black farmers who certainly at this stage, bar some notable exceptions, don't have what it takes to produce food certainly on the same level? Many experts at this stage, Kate, are saying that the transition to increased black ownership of commercial farmland must happen slowly until a massive skills transfer has happened from the large-scale white food producers to their black compatriots, guided by government and agricultural organizations. But of course, we know slow is not in a politician's lexicon, especially with a national election looming in a few months' time. That said, there are indications that the ANC is softening its initial moves towards expropriating white-owned land without compensating its owners. There are indications that its final plan will say that such expropriation can take place, but only under very strict conditions. One of these, for example, could be that if farm laborers have worked the ground on a white farmer's land for a lengthy period of time, that land could be taken from the white farmer and given to his black employees.
Where do things stand at this point?
I wouldn't call it a limbo, but we're on the holiday break, so everyone's taking a break from breaking each other, from wringing each other's necks in Parliament, etc., fighting over this issue, which has caused a lot of animosity. A few weeks ago, the ANC tabled its bill in Parliament that would, in theory, make it easier for it to take land from whites. Within the next few months, the ANC will face heavy opposition to its plans from various political parties. These parties may also decide to contest the bill in court to prevent it from becoming law. But even if it does pass into law, President Cyril Ramaphosa has assured everyone that his party will not be pursuing wholesale expropriation of white-owned land.
What's next, then, in this process?
Given the ANC's big majority in Parliament and the fact that it's supported by one of the main opposition parties, namely the Economic Freedom Fighters, the bill, although maybe not in its current form, will likely become law. Now, as soon as this happens, according to some legal experts I've spoken with, the ANC will probably carefully identify some white-owned land and expropriate it, to, or at least try to expropriate it, to test the law. So, going forward now, we can expect a lot more tension around the land issue as various political parties try to take advantage of the issue ahead of the election.
That was Darren Taylor in Johannesburg speaking with Kate Pound Dawson in Washington.
With 200 million people aged between 15 and 24, Africa has the youngest population in the world. The current trend indicates that this figure will double by 2045, according to the 2012 African Economic Outlook report. Even though there's a fast and steady economic growth in Africa, the World Bank estimates 60% of all African youth are unemployed. To shed light on the problem, I asked VOA's Jackson Mfungani, host of Upfront, a youth-focused show, what could be done to create employment for young Africans.
So, Yehias, you're right. The continent has one of the highest youth unemployment rates around the world. Experts say that there are so many ways to tackle this problem, and one of them would be to invest in agriculture. The continent has the highest amount of arable land, unused arable land. 60% of the arable land has not been farmed on. 60% of the arable land on the continent is unused, on a continent that imports a lot of food. That is an opportunity for African governments to increase youth participation by injecting capital, giving grants to young people who want to start, you know, businesses in, you know, in agriculture and other supply chains around agriculture. And that will have an effect, you know, providing youth employment, but also feeding the continent. We know the continent imports a lot of food from outside the world. And so the question is, why are we importing all this food when we have so much land that is arable, that is farmable, and we have a lot of potential farmhands or potential labor, free labor that is sitting on the continent that needs the jobs that would come out of investing in agriculture. There's the digital divide is decreasing, a lot of uptake in technology, mobile penetration, internet penetration is among the highest around the world, and that provides opportunities for young Africans to start startup companies locally and globally focused. I was in Morocco this year in Casablanca, where I met, you know, over 100 young youth entrepreneurs who have startup companies, tech startup companies. They're saying they would love to have government participation, government contribution. By that, they mean that they need an environment where they feel they can do their businesses effectively. So governments need to invest in technology, in hubs, in training. But most importantly for me, I think one of the ways to tackle youth unemployment on the continent would be education reform. There's no use educating young people, thousands of young people, and offloading them on a labor market when they have no skills to actually use. And so we need an education that reflects the challenges and the needs of the continent. Why do we continue to have thousands of graduates coming from universities looking for jobs in government offices when they could be starting their own companies? Encourage them. You know, the education should focus on entrepreneurship. And many others can be done in that front, Yehes.
So another point, Jackson, I'd like to raise is young women feel the sting of unemployment even more sharply. The African Development Bank found that in most countries in sub-Saharan Africa and all of those in Northern Africa, it is easier for men to get jobs than it is for women, even if they have equivalent skills and experiences. How is it possible to rectify this problem?
Right. So that problem is not specific only to the African continent. We see that that's a global problem, whether it's here in the US, whether it's in Europe, but it's much more compounded in Africa. When there are fewer jobs available to young people, it's most likely that young men will get those jobs than women. And so what we need is policies that actually look into how we can level the playing field, where if a young woman has the same skills and capabilities as a young man, that the job market looks at them the same way without considering them as they need to take off the gender focus. We need to stop thinking that women or men can do jobs differently. If you have the same skills, I think you should be able to have the same opportunities available to you.
That was Jackson Mfunganye, host of Upfront, a youth-focused show on VOA. Thank you for listening to our special edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Justin Thwaites, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London!
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA, or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on the Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
And AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Looking for the day's biggest news stories?
Then start your day with Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Daybreak's 30-minute program comes to you Monday through Friday at 300, 400, 500, and 600 UTC. We are also live on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com.
The Voice of America.